I'm afraid we'll have to. Dorsal is carting a load of cyber technology around 19th century Europe. He's an anachronism heading to a temporal paradox. I'm Chris Bybee.
And I'm Eddie Webb.
And today we talk about Big Finish, the Silver Turk. Eddie, what was that music? That wasn't the music that started the Silver Turk.
I know, because that theme is garbage and I don't like it.
Yes! That was going to be my first point I wanted to bring up, because I'd never listened to the Silver Turk before, and I'd listened to some of the other ones like Storm Warning, and Neverland, and Zagreus, and I jumped back for this because I heard good things about it, and I was going to pull that thing where Chris doesn't know a piece of media, and then we still try to do it anyway and see what happens. And I was like, let's do, what the fuck is this? This isn't Doctor Who.
So, okay. Brief history of the themes of the Eighth Doctor, because he has like four of them, which is fucking weird. But we mentioned last episode that we kind of briefly mentioned Lucy Miller. And so kind of what happened was the era we were first talking about was very much the, this is Doctor Who going forward, so we're going to make a theme in line with something that was like the movie theme, but different. And because that's not the movie theme either. And then with Lucy Miller, they wanted something that was kind of like the current show theme, but also the idea was it was supposed to be a half step between the classic theme and the modern theme. And the correct answer to that is just use movie theme, but they made a whole new theme and it's just not good. And then when it got rebooted again for the currently ongoing, which is Dark Eyes, and then all the four box sets going after that, they gave him a new theme, which is a lot better because it's just a straight up kind of orchestral theme now that uses some of the reprises from the Eighth Doctor theme. It's still not my favorite, but it's better than this one. Now, this is the middle ground. Nick Briggs got an idea in his head theme, and it's not good, and I don't like it.
So as a person that is full of random ideas, I cannot say anything bad anymore about the theme.
Oh, you can. I absolutely will. But I mean, this is... It's a weird thing, because, like, there are shows that... I mean, Doctor Who has constantly regenerated its theme. But it's weird for... It's a weird aberration, right? Like, you don't have the same creative cast having so many multiple themes over its lifetime. So it's kind of a strange, weird moment. The only thing it's kind of equivalent is Transformers, because it had four themes in the original cartoon continuity, counting the movie theme. But even then, like, it was still a pretty radical change from the first two themes, the last two themes. So I don't know. I don't know why I'm so on themes right now. It's just kind of where I'm at.
Interesting. So I don't think we need to give a big history of Big Finish, because we've done that, I think, twice, right? Three times now. And we can don't want to quite dive into the episode yet, because this episode is going to be relatively chunky, because I said I hadn't heard it before. And so I didn't understand how in-depth and swirly this was. It was... Basically, you've got a milkshake, you've got a 23-ounce milkshake, and you're pouring it into an 18-ounce glass is how this episode goes. Right. And so that means there's all this extra stuff that's going everywhere. And it goes back to a principle I keep saying all the time. You cannot undervalue a great editor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to say that this doesn't have a great editor, but I'm saying they may have taken a nap while they're editing.
So, again, this is kind of a weird situation. So, for context, the Eighth Doctor had been kind of out of the monthly range that we talked about last episode. And the Lucy Miller range was a separate range. It was the first time Big Finish had really done that with one of the Doctors. It's now... actually how all of them are done now. The monthly range is over and now every Doctor has their own range. But they wanted to, they did a special Eighth Doctor thing called A Company of Friends, which is 4 half-hour episodes covering all of his companions that were not radio exclusive. So it covered one of his comic book companions, it covered one of his novel companions, it covered Bernie Summerfield's, because they briefly met during one of the novels, and Mary Shelley. So that one-off little episode was a pilot for this kind of mini era, because what they kind of wanted to do was they wanted to see, because they realized Eighth Doctor is an interesting place, they could do multiple eras with him in the same way they kind of have done with other Doctors. The problem is that it's what's supposed to be a relatively light continuity free dip into the Eighth Doctor, because the Lucy Miller range had become fairly continuity heavy, relies on so much continuity that's even outside of Big Finish, and they cram it into 6 hours of audio to have an entire, like I said, era of the Eighth Doctor. It just doesn't really work. They do this again slightly better when they move to the 4-disc box set option. So and basically they have an era in 16 hours as opposed to 6. And that worked, that method works a lot better, but this is kind of a pilot for that. And it's trying to be something that is a whole new thing while evocative of the original Eighth Doctor. It's something that new fans can understand, but classic fans get something out of. It's just trying to do way too goddamn much. It's fun, don't get me wrong. I actually like the Mary Shelley run. But the Silver Turk is just busy.
So then, what do you think of the concept of the Doctor picking up historical people as companions? Quick one-off companions, how he might have done on a television series, but like you're saying, like a companion who travels with him for a few years.
I kind of dig it. It's not something you can do very often, right? And spoiler for the third story, but Mary Shelley gets off the bus at the end of the third story. So her time with the Doctor is not that long, actually. But, like, if you were going to do it with any character, doing it with the grandmother of science fiction makes a ton of thematic sense. And also the gothic horror underpinnings of Frankenstein work really well with the Eighth Doctor specifically. So like it's one of those things that it's a kind of a shock when it happens, but once you think about it for a second, it's like, no, it's like it makes perfect sense the Eighth Doctor would hang out with Mary Shelley and want to impress her and talk shit about her husband in a way that's a little weird, like he's jealous of Mary Shelley's actual husband. except for the fact that Byron is kind of a dick and kind of deserves it, so you at least see his point.
So I'm of multiple minds about this, but first I want to point out that the Doctor is flirting with Mary Shelley, who is 18. I'm gonna bring that out because when we talked about vampires, I talked about 400-year-old vampires hitting on like 18 and 20-year-old people. I have the same issue with the Doctor, who is well over 1,000. I don't care what you say. Even by the cigarette, it's over 1,000.
900 years old.
18-year-old Mary Shelley. Just saying. But.
Who's also married.
Yes. Well, if you know Lord Byron, maybe that's. So anyway, the point I'm going to make is I went back for Mary's story and how she met the same Doctor in different phases of his existence, which is pretty interesting. What I do not like about this part of it, and I've seen them do it before, is when Doctor Who takes or becomes the impetus for people having done what they're known for. The Doctor equivalently becomes Frankenstein for Mary Shelley's stories and kind of is the inspiration for her to create them.
Right.
I don't like that at all. Like never liked something that takes away from someone else's creativity and brilliance they did by themselves.
I mean, yeah, they kind of did that with the Agatha Christie story too.
Yes.
So, I mean, yeah, it is a trope that I'm not great with either, and I'm just going to mention that the episode Rosa exists and move on with my life, but that's a particularly egregious example of it.
Yeah, I was going to make my way there too if you hadn't. So it's something I hate, I despise, I said it, I'll put that to the back burner for a moment. It's going to come back, though, when we talk about Galvanic Lightning. Just saying. I did no back research on it because I wanted to come into this completely open. So is there anything else you would like to talk about before we move into the episode proper?
I think that's mainly it. This was something that if you listen to the whole 2 minutes of interviews, which is just scanty, it's a shame. But they talk about – one thing I like about Big Finish is that they actually have their little features – going forward at the end of it, and they had to interview with the writers and the actors and whatnot. There's not a ton of information on this one because they're still kind of figuring that out, and they needed to put the music in there for some god reason. But one of the things that's kind of clear is that they were really happy with the Mary Shelley one, which is supposed to be kind of a one-off thing. They were so happy with it that they rewrote the ending to A Company of Friends to make it an ongoing thing. And they just had to find time to actually make this run of three stories of Mary Shelley stuff. So a lot of it is on the strength of the actor. Get her name, something Cox.
Julia Cox.
Julia Cox, thank you.
I don't think that the initial one was the same actress, though, was it? I think Mary's sure story Cox was someone else.
I'm pretty sure it was both. But I could be wrong.
Now that you mentioned it, you brought up a point I wanted to bring up when you said Julia Cox's name. The reason I know Julia Cox's name so quickly is a Dune reference. She was Princess Erlyn in the 2000 sci-fi TV series version.
Okay.
All right. Dune and Doctor Who, side by side.
Yeah, they're just identical.
I thought you understood that spice is what powers the TARDIS. It's not the Eye of Harmony, it's spice.
That's how the doctor's. He's not half human, he's half Fremen.
I'm not.
Now, just imagine the doctor, like, by the console, just snorting lines of spice. But anyway.
But he would have blue eyes. How the horses have blue eyes in this. All right. I'm ready to get into it now that I'm segueing this back to it.
Let's do it.
So much like all the other ones, how they're broken down, it actually has four episodes, which feels very nice. It's very reminiscent of the actual show itself in the old days, not so much now. So for part one, opens with the mother singing the creepiest song to a baby. I mean, Jesus, that should go into a horror movie.
Yeah.
And we shift over to Johann Dorsal's monster that kills a frightened Leopold Krauss, patron of Stallman's. The doctor is playing a game of where in the world is Mary Shelley with the famous writer. Vienna is her final guess in the end to slowly introduce her to traveling in the TARDIS. They go to a cafe to wait for his two companions, Samson and Gemma. Pausing, Eddie, who are Samson and Gemma as I am not up on this air?
They were some throwaway companions that he was supposed to be traveling with before he fell into the Mary Shelley sub-era. I believe Samson and Gemma were comic book companions from the Doctor Who magazine, but otherwise, meh.
Last question that I'm not going to give you time to answer before I move on. Did Samson have all of his hair? Count Rolf Weidemeyer. Wow, I butchered that name. I'm so tired. Stallman is a Stallman patron, is trying to get his money back from the investments he made in the Silver Turk after losing everything in the stock market crash. The Silver Turk is an automaton that is on exhibit at the Vienna Exposition that plays music and plays games. Stallman refuses to give back the count any of his money and says, how about instead you gamble against the Silver Turk in public, and that is how I'll return your investments. And for some reason, the count says, cool beans, let's do this. Pausing.
To go back a little bit, one thing I will say for this era, and frankly for Paul McGann, I swear to God, Paul McGann has instant chemistry with anybody. Because like that kind of guess where we're at thing, it's so rapid fire and it immediately builds a fun relationship between these two characters in a very, very short space. Within about 5 minutes, you're like, okay, these two are going to have fun together. And then, of course, it goes horribly wrong because that's what Doctor Who does. But that kind of like, you know, warmer, colder, you know, that whole bit is actually just really fun.
That was the best part of the entire first episode for me. Because I'm not going to lie, we started with the creepy song. And that was like, is this going to go more horror than I think it is? I knew it was going to have horror tendencies. But when we got to Drossel and his monster and the frightened guy in the cab cart, that felt rushed and like it needed more something. I don't know if it needed more explanation to build up because it didn't make me intrigued. It actually kind of turned me off and I stopped listening for a couple. I put it away and then I came back to it later.
There's another point we'll get to later where I'll definitely agree with you on that. But there's a muddiness around the audio direction that is Big Finish falls into roughly three eras for me, and this is kind of the middle era. The previous era, the scripts were simpler, and therefore the audio direction was pretty clear because they were trying relatively simple, straightforward, classic Doctor stories. They get more experimental and ambitious, but at least the whole story is based around the experimental ambition, and there's not much else going on. In this one, they're a little more confident, and I think what's happening is that they've stretched their resources a bit too thin, and so things like the audio direction gets a little muddy. Like you said, maybe the script could use a pettis. And then after that, it becomes a lot less experimental, but they've developed a formula and they execute it very well. So everything works really well because they know exactly what they're doing. So it loses some of the energy of the first two eras, but this era has a lot of the energy of the first era, but doesn't have the technical expertise and the confidence to go with it. And so, yeah, you get stuff like, it's clearly intended to be, what the hell is this? What's going on? I mean, I'm curious. And it just comes noticeably, what the hell's going on? Did I miss a track or something?
Yeah. And so I literally put it away for a day before I came back to it. All right. The Count. Count Wittermeier.
He's an idiot.
Eddie. Part of this is now using future knowledge for the thing. But if I were a wealthy count and someone I knew that my wife had a previous relationship with, I would not go and invest in their business. I don't care how much money I have. And I would not trust them to have my best interest at mind.
Right.
So why would he go and invest in the Silver Turk at all?
I answer your question with a counterexample. Why would you buy a failing social media network and invest millions of dollars into it only to drive it into the ground? Because rich people are stupid, Chris. That's why.
Then you've already answered my next question for you is why would you then agree to a public contest with this automaton that you've seen beat dozens of other people and not have anything set up like, all right, you know what? I'll take 10% of whatever the gross is to start paying me back. But no. If I win, you said that you will potentially pay me back. Sure, that's good enough for me.
Right. I mean, what's happening here is that they're trying to establish who the Turk is and also set up the personal dynamics between three characters. Because again, one thing that's kind of happening in this era of Big Finish particularly is their ambition's growing, but they're also not increasing the size of their cast. So this story would have landed better if there was about one more character in the midst here.
I can see that.
Because the guy who made the Turk is doing double duty as foil to the Count and love interest, quote unquote, to Mitzi, which we haven't gotten to yet. It's all spread a bit thin. And then you have not one, but two. Well, we'll get to that. Cyber people. But It's again, there's a lot of ambition here, but either they need to be some stuff cut out, like you said, or this needs to be expanded to one more disc to have a couple more episodes to give this relationship more room to breathe, right? Yeah, but what's happened is it's kind of all crammed in. And again, like to your point, I think the intention is these are very strange actions, what's going on, to intrigue you to listen to more, but A, it really doesn't. It just sounds confusing. And B, it doesn't go anywhere, which is even more frustrating.
Absolutely. Oh, I am going to take a step back because this is the only time I'll like to point this out, is that they don't specifically mention that the TARDIS enables people to understand languages everywhere you go. And there is a wondrous joy in how Julie Cox is playing Mary Shelley, that she understands German and how she can read it. And she understands words that she doesn't know the meaning of. Like, that is unbelievable. It is not only does the TARDIS translate for you, but it translates and then puts it into a manner that you can comprehend regardless of who you are.
And I just love her reaction of like, oh my God, I understand German. This is amazing. I've been trying so hard and I finally get it. And you can almost feel as an established actor, you're a fan of the Eighth Doctor going, I don't want to take this away from her, so I'm just going to move on. You know, travel broadens the mind. Like, he just explained the TARDIS. He's just like, good job, Mary. You figured that out. It's totally not my alien psychic technology infesting your brain.
I loved it. Like, that is a part that was... makes me want to go and write Doctor Who. Anything else before we move on?
No, I want to get to the next bit because there's all the next bit.
Mary and the Doctor realize they are in 1873 and Samson and Gemma are decades away. The Silver Turk beats the Count, who is furious, and threatens Stallman, but is thrown out into the streets at the Vienna Exposition, where the Doctor and Mary arrive shortly afterwards. They overhear talks of puppets without strings. Count Wittemeyer's wife, Mitzi, whom Stallman used to be in love with 4 years ago, visits him between performances in hopes of finding her husband. Stallman suggests that they leave Vienna together tomorrow. He's interested in her influence in the royal circles, but she protests his embrace, saying, nay, I am married now and have a daughter who she sings the creepiest songs to. Bradfish, a cabbie, badgers the two time travelers into his service and tells him that he witnessed a blue-eyed horse and gabs on about vicious murders and people losing their eyes. The trio overhears a distressed countess and offers to help her. Bradfish knows that the count was arrested maybe 15-20 minutes ago. Convenient. At the police station, the countess, Mary, and the doctor are given 5 minutes to talk to the count, who curses Stallman and his automaton. He describes how he was attacked by a misshapen monster with three legs growing from its shoulders and a bandaged head shaped like a table vase. The doctor decides to pay a visit to the Silver Turk. The doctor catches Stallman feeding cabbage soup to the Silver Turk, and he asks if he can investigate the Turk. Stallman refuses, and the doctor makes a comment about, I didn't know that a machine needed to eat, as he leaves.
Right. So, on the one hand, I really love the fact that... So, traditionally, when the Doctor gets a new companion, there's the... At some point, you go into the past, sometimes you go into the future, and sometimes you go into the present day. I love the fact that this is simultaneously a historical from our perspective, but a future story from Mary's perspective. So I actually really dig that kind of her getting all of the, you know, oh my God, all my friends are dead. That kind of classic companion understanding what's like to live in the future thing. But from our perspective, it's a Victorian era story. So that's fun. I really enjoyed that.
I love the fact that she, I'm not sure if it happens here or later, but she knows it's about 50 odd years in her future. And she's like, oh my God, what do I look like?
Right.
She doesn't know how time travel works.
Right. The counterpoint to that, however, is this commits one of the biggest sins that you can do in audio production, which is that Mitzi sounds just like Mary. And it's really hard to tell them apart.
Maybe.
I mean, and it's initially they're in separate scenes, so it's not a big deal. But as it goes on, spoiler, Mitzi and Mary occasionally have scenes together, and it's to the point where it's like it's hard to tell who's talking, and that's really not good.
So this thing commits the usual Doctor Who sin that I really dislike, and dislike more in this one, is except for the Seventh Doctor, doesn't have currency, and the fact that he's just going to like cafes and he's getting cab rides everywhere pains me physically as someone who was a waiter and has done a lot of things, that means if he didn't have someone encounter someone nice with money, he's stiffing that person as they work. That's not the sign of a hero. That's a sign of a lout, a hooligan who deserves a quick punch to the face. The fact that we also then transitioned to the love affair between Stalban and Mitzi, and given that that love affair was 4 years ago, but is so strong that he's still trying to pull her away from the count right now, regardless of their family and daughter, reinforces for me why did the count invest, because he would have known about this relationship the whole time, unless they're a throuple. Just saying.
Well, I mean, we're not going to get that doctor here, let's be honest. But also, it's again, ages are not mentioned in Mitzi's hand, but given she sounds so much like Mary, Mitzi's probably in her early to mid 20s. You know, so that's a whole separate thing, which, you know, I'm going to put a certain amount of it was the time, and that's how people, you know, got married and age of consent were different and whatever. I'm just kind of lightly put that to the side. But it's trying to be a Regency romance and a horror story and a Doctor Who story. And I am all for it. I think Doctor Who does really good at genre meshing, right? And I think that when it does it well, it can be really exciting. I mean, we just recently saw Doctor Who as a musical, and it's like, that's a really cool way to mash things up. But the problem is that when you have all that happening, you get two parallel stories of scientific men trying to take women away from their husbands that gets really icky after a while.
Mm-hmm. And okay. Now I need to ask you, Eddie, as a person in Europe that travels around, would you go to the exposition? Would you yourself go to watch a Silver Turk? And we've now already gotten the sense that it's just in bandages and is silver somehow. Right. And we'll find out later that it has no legs. And would you go to this exhibit to watch some sort of, generally say, automaton? I don't know how anyone thinks it's an automaton. I don't at all. Makes no sense from the description, from what we get, from all that, even in 1873.
I mean, I will say, thankfully, the habit of watching disfigured people for entertainment has fallen out of fashion in the UK. Insert rant about J.K. Rowling here. But this is based off of something historical, at one of the expositions of an actual automaton that was able to play chess. And people did actually pay a lot of money to go watch. I think it only did chess. And even that might be, I may be wrong about the game, but it did one thing. It was an early example of robotics.
So, but I guess I'm getting to the point that I'll give it the conceit because it makes it interesting for us to listen to and discuss. Mm-hmm. But if you are a patron there looking at it, it would reek of ether and cabbage because they've already established that the doctor could smell mm-hmm. it from across the room. So that means all the patrons have to be able to smell it and see it. And it wouldn't have the aesthetics of what an automaton would have. Even the ones that are all carved that we'll get to later would look different than it and be more automaton-like. So it then becomes, how are they seeing it as an automaton given all those factors?
Well, I mean, the doctor does... The doctor does mention, actually, in this scene that it has a mask because he plucks it off. So the idea that it's wrapped in bandages kind of backstage, but maybe has a different presentation in front is possible, is plausible. But I think to the larger point, it goes back to both of our earlier concerns, which is that the action is unclear, which again is devastating in audio drama. The scene is, they're trying to go for naturalistic language, which I applaud, and Big Finish is generally really good at that, at describing a scene using natural language. But in this case, it is all a bit muddy, and it's a little unclear what's happening, why it's happening. Like the horses with blue eyes thing is supposed to be a big clue, but why that's a big clue, it has to be spelled out near the end of the story. Because the doctor seems like, oh, horses have blue eyes. It's like, well, okay, do horses normally have blue eyes? Is that a weird thing? And I've never looked at a horse's eyes before, right? but if it had been like, you know, their eyes were glowing, okay, that's a little clearer that this is fucking weird, right?
Well, you know, whenever I encounter a horse, Eddie, I make direct eye contact with it at all time. It's how you stop it from hoofing you.
Right, because you threaten it. Or punch it out.
Before I move on to the last bit.
No, I think something else.
The doctor is appalled at the performance at how the Turk plays Beethoven. Mary realizes that the Turk somehow works the pedals despite having no legs. The doctor disrupts the performance to the displeasure of the punters and proposes a game of checkers, but demands to see the actual form of the Silver Turk. Stalbin protests, and the doctor accuses him of fraud, noting that the Turk stinks of, as I said before, antiseptics and cabbage soup, suggesting a living being rather than a fairground automaton. The doctor leaps over and removes the mask, confirming his suspicions that the Silver Turk is a Cyberman! A Mondasian Cyberman.
It was this part that had a mask. I forgot about that part.
End of part one. Dun, dun, dun. Oh, I love
it. And this is... Okay, I've said it before, but I'm going to bring it up. Classic Doctor Who has this really dumb obsession with telling you exactly what the twist is going to be and still acting like the twist is a surprise at the end of episode one. When something has "of the Daleks" in the title and then the big reveal in episode one is, oh my God, there are Daleks involved. It's like, it's not really a twist or a reveal. It's just kind of the thing we were waiting for.
But this mask, Eddie, it's the title of the thing. It's called the Silver Turk.
Well, sure, but the graphic art on the cover has a Cyberman right in the fucking middle of it.
You know what I think would have probably made me feel better, which is also why I gave it some stick over here, is that if they had like a form in a mask, the mask, whatever it was that was wearing, within a hidden part of that, and you would have had a real surprise until you read the back cover that said Cyberman on it. But
right. No, and that's the thing is also it's funny because we're giving so much stick to a story I actually kind of like, but like the whole this head was shaped like a jug. I mean, it's like it's so clearly like, get it? It's a Cyberman, right? But it's like it's such a weird detail. I mean, it's like, okay, why is his head shaped like a jug? You feel like either more should be made of that. People should be going, that's such a really strange. If it's an automaton, strange design decision, or if it's a person, why do they have that head shape? That seems odd. But it just throws detail because, again, it's supposed to be a detail to get the doctor to realize what's going on. But it's not. It's for the fans to go, aren't you clever for knowing it's Cyberman, the reveal of the thing that's on the cover of the CD you bought?
All right. I will rarely say this, but then does that mean that we are too familiar with Doctor Who and its tropes to look at this without cynicism?
If you are buying the 120th installation of a monthly Doctor Who audio drama series, you are probably exactly as cued in as you and I are, right?
Hey, if I was an 18-year-old that had read Frankenstein for the first time and I started researching Mary Shelley and I got linked here, I could have purchased this. Look, it's Mary Shelley doing science fictiony stuff.
But then his head thing sounds like just complete nonsense because at no point is that explained at any point in the story. You have to visually know what a Cyberman is to understand that reference.
But it could the jug-shaped head could be for all the circuits inside that enables it to play. I'm just giving you shit now because it's
right.
Fun.
You know, I know you are. I know you are. It's again, and this is where I think it's like it's trying to do too many things at once, right?
Yes, 100%.
If the doctor had been like, when he approaches it, and then he walks out of that meeting with Stallman and goes, "Oh, it's because this guy's a Cyberman," right? And just lays out front, and then the twist here is that the doctor reveals that it's alive or something. You know, like there could be a slightly different twist here. It still keeps the structure more or less intact. But they're so committed to this very specific trope of the completely pointless reveal, which most of the time I really love in Doctor Who. I really love when it's really committed to a completely bullshit cliffhanger. I have expressed my love of the nonsense cliffhanger before. The Mentad knocking the Doctor down for him to get up 2 seconds later in the next episode. I love it. But here it's so obviously building to the cliffhanger that it's doing damage to the earlier part of the episode.
I agree. But at the same time, now that we're pausing just a beat before we move on to the next one, isn't this entire run the punchline to an ongoing joke for the Eighth Doctor?
In what regard? Literally
from his creation in Storm Warning, he talks about all these people he met and Mary Shelley and everything else.
Right, right.
And it's been something he mentions constantly. He name drops worse than Tom Baker did.
So I'm conflicted. On the one hand, you're absolutely right. This entire run exists primarily because of a throwaway line in the very first audio drama. On the other hand, Big Finish has literally spent 25 years doing nothing but making exactly this kind of canon hole plugging stuff. Like, nobody needed 50 plus hours of the Time War, but how do we have it now, right? So, I mean, this is what they do, right? You know, like, no one's been like, I need to have 6 more hours of Mags the Werewolf from the fucking Seventh Doctor era, but we have that now.
I need that. I still haven't bought it yet, but I intend to go buy it to listen to it because I think Mags is a pretty fun, almost companion.
Right. You know, apparently I didn't know I needed more Eric Roberts Master, but that now exists, and it turns out I kind of do, actually.
I will say that if anyone from Big Finish is actually listening to this podcast, I need 6 to 12 hours of Bembera and having her
yes.
own series.
Oh, God. It's like we have some 2000 unit. We have the 2010s unit. We have some historical 70s unit. We need that middle unit era with Bembera. It just needs to happen. Make it happen.
And if they want, I'm willing to bet they could go talk to David Tennant and he would come back again as like that evil unit officer.
Oh, yeah. Don't even credit him. Give him a pseudonym.
Just happily.
Right.
Tennant David would come back and do it.
Right. So, I mean, like, I can't be mad at a company who is like, we're going to be super obsessed about extremely minor plot points in this old television drama because I am exactly the audience for that. So I'm not mad about it. I get frustrated when the fanboyishness gets in the way of telling a good story. And that is what I feel like is happening in this first episode.
Yes. And it just goes back to that. Much like, I'll even give you this one, Ghostlight, it needs an extra episode. It does.
Yeah, yeah.
So everything has room to breathe, and then you can plug in some of the rushed parts that make it feel better. I'm also going to say, though, I think that might have made it too long at that point.
Well, I mean, the other option is, you know, and we've said this before, if you would cut out some of, say, the Stallman-Mitzi romance subplot. And I get it. It's the you want to have a reason for each character to have a reason to bounce off each other. But that love triangle takes up a slightly too much time. You could cut that down to just being Stallman, and we haven't gotten to his partner yet, but just Stallman and his partner, and they're trying to bring Cyberman back and the Cyberman's plans. I mean, that's a solid 4-episode beat right there. And then Mary Shelley coming to terms with time travel. That's enough, I think. I think that this was just a little too much. And so, like, if you pull that out, give everything else room to breathe, that's stronger. And again, one of the things that Big Finish has been dinged by some fans for is that in the modern era, they are better about paring those stories down and giving everything room to breathe. It sometimes can come across as a little staid. I don't mind that, particularly when they do that in a service of trying some new interesting things, which I mentioned before. The current Eighth Doctor stuff is actually really, really good because they're steadily marching him closer and closer to the War Doctor, and they can take as long as they want to do that. So they can do very, very, very slow burns in a way that they can't do when you're trying to cram it all into 6 hours.
So, A, I'll give you a warning for this one instead of doing how I normally with the game. I am going to ask you when we hit the end of this, what are like your top 3 to 5 recommendations if people want to get into Big Finish? Not right now, but I'm going to ask you later. Give you time to think about it while we walk through this. Part two. Da-da-da. You play crappy opening introduction music. The doctor warns everyone they're in danger, and Stalbin grudgingly instruct Hans to refund the cost of the tickets. The doctor explains to Mary that this Cyberman is one from Mandas, and the people there were facing extinction and replacing their body parts with machines until they became brutal and soulless. Mary sympathizes with the seamlessly helpless creature. The doctor refuses to leave until Stalbin explains how he came by the Turk. Elsewhere, Drussel decides to let loose the dog, which gives him the scent of Count Wittermeier, who escaped earlier. Stalbin admits to buying and repairing it. The Countess Wittermeier believes that it was simply a matter of money, the money of her husband, who is now accused of murder. The doctor confirms the two eyeless murder victims were also Stalbin's patrons. They correctly surmise that Count Wittermeier was supposed to be the third victim. While arguing, the Turk unbidding plays a piano and refuses to stop. Mary comes to the Turk's defense. The doctor attributes this to compassion, explains to her that the Cybermen have no feelings. Still, Mary points out that the Count described his attacker as having 3 limbs, which the Countess confirms, remembering that they grew from their shoulders, which the Silver Turk does not have.
So, my complaint first, I'm going to try to do it in reverse order. You would think someone having limbs growing from their shoulders would be a slightly more distinctive feature than someone having the head shaped like a jug, but neither here nor there. Again, it's another twist of like, oh, this is the vital piece of information we need, and it's like, oh, half a second of looking at these things tell they're 2 completely different characters. But again, I'm not gonna stare too much. I do Drossel. Okay, 2 things. One is I feel like Drossel comes in a bit too late, because what this story desperately needs is a clear villain, and Drossel is that, but we don't realize he's the clear villain until the beginning of this episode.
I was going to say that I thought he came in too early, because it starts with Drossel and the monster after the creepy song for part one.
Well, but we don't have context for what's going on. Drossel is in episode 1. The fact that he is the villain is not clear until this episode. Right?
If you have something that kills someone, you're usually a villain for me. So that's where...
Right. But it's... Well, okay. All right. Then it, I think maybe it goes back to just the muddiness of the whole thing, right? Like it's not clear what's actually happening until this point. So maybe what I'm saying more is that the fact there's a villain is obvious. And I agree with you completely. The fact there is a clear villain is thing. The fact is who he is and how he relates to the rest of the cast is the part that's unclear until here.
Correct. I agree with that.
And so the clarity for how he relates to the rest of the cast comes too late for me. But all that said, I do love the exchange where the doctor goes into great detail about the fact that they're Mondasian Cybermen, and that is an important point. And Mary going, how is this clarifying anything whatsoever?
The Mondasian Cybermen are the best Cybermen.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I love it. I love the fact that they're digging into this little weird niche of Cyberman lore. And I love the fact that Mary is just no-selling the hell out of it. And it's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. It's
love a great that, moment but also of
like, the fans understand what's happening, but the companion, zero clue.
True, but I also love the fact that she's taking it in and processing it. She doesn't know what to do with it, but she's just kind of storing it in the back of her mind. Like, beautiful.
No, yeah, it is not. She's not the dumb companion trope, and that's one thing I really love about Mary Shelley in this run is that at no point in time is she portrayed as an idiot. She is portrayed as not understanding what's happening, but not from a lack of knowledge, not from a lack of ability. And so, and she plays a typical role of a companion, where she plays the heart And again, this is one place where it's a little money because the reason why there's a conflict here is purely because we as the audience know the Cybermen are evil. The Doctor does not actually make a compelling case at any point as to why we should hate the Cybermen. And Mary correctly argues against it. If you do not have the context of who Cybermen are, the Doctor looks like just a fucking asshole here. Because Mary is 100% correct with the knowledge she has. This man is being tormented and abused, and why are you not stopping that?
Which, this is obviously a parallel to the episode Dalek from the Ninth Doctor run with Ninth Doctor and Rose, because they fall directly into those throughout the entire course of this episode.
Right.
And I love the Eighth Doctor and how he's doing it, but it is too close a parallel to that for this to work for me, having viewed that the Dalek episode.
Right.
So I enjoy audio media and how it lets me imagine things, but there is still more power, I think, in a visual medium in some senses for what they can do, because that story loses the murkiness that is in this audio version.
Which I think we're jumping ahead slightly, but I think that's kind of the big catch-22 of Big Finish, right? In the sense that a lot of times Big Finish is trying to do what-if television episodes. And the more they lean that direction, the worse they get. When Big Finish embraces the fact that it is audio media specifically, it could do some absolutely amazing stuff in a distinctive and unique way. Another Eighth Doctor example actually is Scherzo, which I mentioned before. But if you televised Scherzo, it would be 2 hours of people walking in a literal circle. It would be the most dull television imaginable. But because it's audio, it's actually really compelling and interesting. I'm not being hyperbolic. They literally do walk in a circle for 2 hours. That's the entire plot of Scherzo, believe it or not. It's better than that, but it sounds terrible.
Do you know who can make it awesome?
Who?
Patrick Newman, if he's still alive.
Oh, well, that's true, too. But this is, you're right. Like, the other problem is the reason why the twist in Dalek works is because the Ninth Doctor is still a cipher to Rose. He appears to be a good man, but we don't know exactly what he's capable of. And so when he makes this twist, both the audience and Rose are like, I don't know if this is the Doctor right now. I don't know if this is something he's capable of. Have things changed? The Eighth Doctor is a known quantity both to the audience and to Mary Shelley. So Mary Shelley, again, in the story is like, why are you acting like this? This is not you. And again, she is correct from the information she has. So the only way this twist works is, which goes to my earlier point, he should have mentioned early on, hey, this is Cyberman, by the way, they're evil cyborgs that try to kill people, get Mary on board, and then having her go, but this one appears to be in pain, and then the conflict makes more sense. But that's just glossed over. It's just, again, it's pitching it to fans going, they don't want to hear us explain Cybermen for the millionth time. And it's like, but this story needs the Doctor to explain Cybermen to Mary.
And at one level, though, it could almost be that this version of the Doctor doesn't feel that same sort of hatred that the Ninth Doctor felt.
Sure.
And so he has a harder time selling someone on it. He just knows this is a factual thing. And so you should believe me because I'm telling you it's a factual thing because we're friends.
Right. Right. Which again is not a bad way of playing it, but it's not a drama, but still it's not on the page. Right.
Mm-hmm. Anything else before we move on?
No, let's move on. Got a long way to go.
Yeah. Dursel asks a nearby cabbie, Bradfish, about the commotion, and he learns that the Turk has broken down during its last performance. Bradfish unwillingly blurts out Stallman's address, and Dursel gives him free tickets to his performance and emphasizes the absence of strings to his attached puppets. The Cyberman has been under permanent sedation as he has lost both legs and one arm. The Doctor is alarmed by the fact that Stallman was able to replace the lost arm with a wooden one that is operational enough to play the piano. This technology should be on anything possible in the 19th century. The Doctor then tries to interrogate the Cyberman about his ship, the crew and their mission. At first, its photocell eyes seem dead, but then the Cyberman becomes animated, and suddenly the Doctor's speech slows down and he falls down to the ground unconscious, while Mary runs out to fetch medical help for the Doctor. Stalbin begs Mitzi to help him and help him to escape with the Turk, and she does.
I mean, we're now halfway through episode two and the actual mystery kicks in, you know, because for the first time, it's like, oh, how does a wooden arm play a piano? But again, like the fact that he has a wooden arm was only mentioned now. So this is doing what in mystery terms we call not playing fair, because in a mystery the idea is that the reader has all the clues the detective has, and so therefore theoretically you could put them together just like detective could, but just don't. And so the idea is there's a little game of trying to sweep your front detective. If this is ultimately a mystery slash horror, I mean, even as a horror, because horrors on some level are mysteries, we should have known pretty early on that one arm's wooden and one arm's metal. It would have been easy to work in, especially when the Doctor examined the Cyberman. So because there was so much other things that needed to get done in that first episode, and again, a commitment to this bizarre cliffhanger, a lot we're now having to stuff that should have been in the first episode is now appearing in the second episode and relatively late in the second episode.
And this goes back to the small cast. The fact that it is constantly this, I know they can't do more, but it's constantly the same people, bends my willingness for to accept how these coincidences of occurrences keep happening. Like dorsal meaning
Brad, the only cabbie in all of Vienna, apparently.
Bradfish actively has to pursue the Doctor and Mary to get them in the cab so he can be part of the story. Bradfish right. does this. Bradfish is there. And it's painful. Like, I can't quite put my finger on it yet, how they could have done it differently, but something feels off. And I know I'm giving a lot of stick. I enjoyed the episode on the whole. I enjoyed the Silver Turk on the whole. I want to say that now, but there's so many pieces to go into that I can nitpick because it is so full of great ideas that are not quite gelled together properly, either with the production or some of the writing itself.
Well, again, like, a certain amount of coincidence happens in Doctor Who, right? Like, to be fair, the premise of Doctor Who is how many times has he gone on vacation only to end up walking into a plot? I mean, there's a fair amount of coincidence that happens in the show. I think for me, what bothers me about Bradfish is that he's so much coincidentally involved with the story that it implies there's something weird going on with Bradfish. It's not. He's just a cabbie. Spoiler. And that's
what's just a cabbie. A cabbie. He's a cabbie to royalty, Eddie.
Right. He's trying to play that Robert Holmesian role of the lower class character who's caught up in higher class stuff and tries to give us that viewpoint view into it from a low class perspective. But A, it's not working on that level. And B, he's just basically, like you said, the plot glue between some of the other disparate storylines. So again, if you cut away one of those storylines, Bradfish doesn't have to hold as much weight. He can be then that viewpoint character into the weirdness of what's going on with the story in that kind of Holmesian tradition. It would have been fine. You could ease up on Bradfish a bit more, and then therefore it wouldn't seem so coincidental he's everywhere. But because you don't have enough room to develop him as a character, even if it's a comedic viewpoint character, then he's left literally chasing after the plot.
Do you know who my favorite driver is in Doctor Who?
Who?
The driver from Inferno, who's just guy doing his job.
Yeah. just trying to do my job, man. They turn. Gotta go back.
Mary finds Bradfish, and both find nobody inside but the unconscious Doctor. Mary is relieved to find that his eyes are still intact. The Countess returns, explaining that she couldn't prevent Stalbin from taking the Turk. The Doctor comes to and says that he's been attacked by the Cyberman and needs time to collect his thoughts. He thinks that Stalban is under the Cyberman's influence and the murders are not the Silver Turk's doing, that the murderer is hunting Stalban and the Silver Turk, and likely that their next victim on the list is Count Wittermeier. The crew race to the police station. The doctor, Mary, and Mitzi arrive and hear screams from the count coming downstairs. They find him alive, but one of his eyes has been plucked out. Mary sees the creature get away as it scuttles like a spider over the rooftops. The doctor breaks the rules of time and gives a remedy to the count that is not available in the 19th century. The attack will likely result in charges against the count being dropped, and the countess goes home to check on their daughter for the first time in hours with Mary, while the doctor and Bradfish once again go in search of Stalban. I got to say, this will be a joke later, is it? I imagine that Bradfish is pretty tired, Eddie. Do you know why?
Why?
He's carrying a lot of this plot on his back.
Yeah, he kind of becomes another companion at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was a nice touch, though, that the Cyberman actually still has some defenses. And yeah. I'm trying to remember the last time I knew of a Cyberman that could do a psychic attack, and I'm coming up blank right now. I feel like it's happened before, but I can't put my finger on it.
I think it was something that was kind of distinctive to the Mondasian Cyberman specifically, because I think that kind of fell away with the Second Doctor's era of Cybermen. They just became kind of big clanking horrors. And I love the weirdness of the Mondasian Cybermen. And so, like, the fact that, you know, yeah, they're just going to, you know, exchange limbs and have psychic attacks and stuff, and they talk weird. It's like, I actually love that era of cyber humanity. And I'm also actually, you know, now that we've gone into the actual horror plot proper now, because again, there's so many plots going on, you know, the eye horror of people having their eyes gouged out and shoved into puppets is actually genuinely creepy.
Yeah.
And this is one place where they're focusing your attention to make sure you really understand the horror of having your eyes missing. And if you're paying attention, all the reference to the eyes here, it's like, oh, last episode they were talking about horses with weird eyes. I can maybe make that connection here. But there's so much going on, you've probably already forgotten that, which is not normally telling the audience information and bearing. It's generally a good tactic for these kinds of thing. In this case, it just gets lost in the tsunami of information. So you couldn't really realistically remember it unless you're paying super close attention, which the story is not encouraging you to do. So,
or you listen to this story like three times how I did.
Right.
Is there nothing else you want to talk about here?
Honestly, not much in this page.
Okay. So before we move on, I, as a horror writer, God, I can't believe I get to say that. I love the description of it scuttling along and going over rooftops like a spider, because that is so evocative of great things. Like, the potential that has is phenomenal, because right now, you can assume something. Like, as you're going through, you think there's one Cyberman in the piece. So you don't know what this other thing is. That's why they constantly refer to it as a dog or a monster here and there. And it's reoccurring constantly throughout. And that's nice. It's a nice beat. And we have we have our four heroes and three companions. Because you'll have Mary, Mitzi, who feels very much like a Turlo-esque companion, because she helps the doctor, but she helps one of the bad guys.
Okay.
And Bradfish. So it feels almost like a TARDIS crew, which is something I like in and of itself.
Right, yeah. I mean, from a high concept, everything here is stuff I should like. But yeah, it's a case where the small cast is not working, or more accurately, the small cast is not being utilized to best effect. It's probably a better way of phrasing that. And there's just too much storyline for what we got going on here.
And my last is a throwing line about the doctor saying Stalban must be under the Cyberman's influence, which then lets you know how he's able to create that arm. It's not blatantly stated, but it's a throwing line right now.
I like that.
All right. Drossel confronts Stalbin, accusing him of stealing the Turk, and Stalbin claims that the Turk is not with him. Drossel once again mentions a new world he's planning to build with his pets and says that Stalbin has no place in it. Stalbin draws down, fires four shots at him. With Drossel appearing unharmed, Stalbin flees. The Wittermeier servant lets her mistress and Mary in once they reach the manor. They hear a horse outside and see a driverless horse-drawn cab across the street. In Stalbin's residence, the doctor and Bradfish find Drossel unharmed, who says Stalbin owes him money and admits that the bullets were intended for him, but claiming the Turk was his own creation. Stalbin stole it to curry favor with the royal family. He threatens the doctor with consequences if he tries to interfere and leaves. The doctor and Bradfish note that there are bullet holes in the wall and also two in Drossel, but no blood. Meanwhile, Mary and Mitzi are besieged. Mary stands against the puppets with a poker, telling Mitzi to go upstairs and guard the child, but she is overpowered and carried away. Mary is put in an animal cage with what she recognizes as another Turk, the other Cyberman. It is so surprising that Mary knows the name of its race that it admits... It is so surprised that Mary knows the name of its race of a Cyberman. It admits that... Wow, I'm stuck on this line. Whoever wrote this needs to go back to preschool. Hey, wait a minute. I wrote this. And Mary knows the name of the race, and it's Cyberman is surprised, and it begins speaking to her. End of part two. Yeah. Can I go back and stumble over that line four more times?
You can.
We're not going to fix that in editing, so I hope people like that.
Well, and of course, you know, the Cyberman is so surprised it learns they can speak. Chris is so surprised he doesn't realize he can speak. So, yes, a whole bunch of plot stuff happened here, but every time I hit this point, I get confused by the horse thing. So, at this point, it seems like what the story is trying to tell me is the weird thing is that these are cyber-converted horses. These are artificial horses or cyber-converted or otherwise not entirely human horses or not entirely horsey horses. I don't know. Not entirely flesh horses, I guess what I'm saying. So I'm like, okay, I'm on board with robot horses. Not a problem. But the weird thing seems to be that there are now cabs that aren't horse-drawn at all. So why have robot horses? And what I've eventually finally figured out after listening to this a few times is that the weird thing is supposed to be that the horses are autonomous, that they can leave the cab and do other secret cyber horse stuff, you know, like, you know, stage revolutions or something. I'm not sure what cyber horses do. I don't begrudge them.
I'm going to put that in a book, Eddie. I want you to know that right now. I'm stealing that from you. Other secret cyber horse stuff. Go in a book. I don't know where.
Yeah, yeah. Quote, so, anyway. I mean, like, that's supposed to be the big kind of thing, because like it's supposed to be a playoff of the there are no strings. The horses aren't tied to their strings and they can do other things. That's supposed to be what's happening here. But why?
So wait, are you telling me that they forecasted the toy maker and his puppets in 2011, knew that they were going to make the doctor fight the toy maker and he was going to make... There you go. Oh, if you can see the look on Eddie's face, he wants to just turn off the camera and stop right now.
You say that, but hilariously, it turns out that there is a new Toymaker Big Finish audio drama coming out, but apparently it was recorded and written before they even knew what was going on the television show.
Oh my goodness.
And it happens to be that the script ran out in a way that actually ties in nicely to that episode, but it was completely unplanned. So the Big Finish do occasionally actually do stumble into this stuff.
Well, all right then.
All right then. But, oh gosh. So, I mean, there's just so much. Now we have this whole Stallman's trying to suck up the royal family plot, which comes out of nowhere. I mean, there's earlier references to like, I need the money so I can impress the emperor to get money, empress to get money thing. But now suddenly it's all he wants to do. And it's just, there's so much happening that you've forgotten about that plot. So when it comes back to emphasize here, it's like, it seems like it's come out of nowhere.
It feels like that. But then if you stop and you think about it, he talks about how he lost his investors, how he refused to do certain things. So it all comes back to money, but it is so jumbled up in so many different things. It's impossible to take that away.
That's the thing, is that you just said it. You have to think about it. And I shouldn't have to be keeping track of all of your various plot points to enjoy the story.
You should, because if you remember when we talked about Dune, it's a Patreon episode if you want to hear it. They put out a book of all the characters for Lynch's Dune before people walked in so they could keep up with everything going on.
Now I am going to turn this camera off. David Lynch's Doctor Who audio drama.
Ooh, I'd buy that.
I know you would.
There's a lot of stuff, but at the same time, it feels like most of it is unimportant, which is the problem.
Right, and that's exactly it. Like, so full context. I had actually listened to this, the whole Mary Shelley run, like 6 months before you asked to do this one. I had forgotten so much of this story in 6 months. So that's when, let's do it again. And that's kind of the overall problem. It's like, it's enjoyable. I enjoy listening to it. I enjoy the performances. I enjoy the story. But afterwards, I remember, oh, that was the one where the Cyberman was pretending to be a dummy or an automaton in Vienna. That's all I remembered of it. So all this other stuff is just noise, which is not bad. It's an enjoyable noise. But you're right. It's so much going on that nothing actually happens.
Any final comments on that, on the end of part two?
No, we're going to start with three now.
The other Cyberman and Mary bond. As she knows it's a Cyberman, she thinks that the Cyberman is in pain due to its loneliness, and she explains the concept of pain to him. He admits to being in pain because of being damaged and malfunctioning. The Cyberman says, "Hey, my name is Graham," and believes this to be his home planet of Mondas. At this moment, Dorso enters like the villain he is and introduces himself, and Graham suddenly turns back, not saying anything, silently. Meanwhile, the doctor surmises Dorsal must be behind this and guesses that the Countess, not Mary, was the target of this abduction. But Bradfish leaves with his cab to go get some sleep because he's tired of being the fucking plot glue. Meanwhile, Mary learns from Dorsal that Graham spends his time working on wood and that Dorsal needs to be made aware, and Dorsal doesn't know that Graham can speak. The doctor returns to the Countess. He's worried about Mary and the potential temporal paradox if she ends up not writing her books. The Countess confesses that she knows how to find the Silver Turk. Cab arrives, and the Countess sends her daughter to be with her sister. Finally, someone to look after this kid, and takes the doctor to where she used to meet Stalbin. Stalbin soon arrives, as she expected. He assures him that the Turk is hidden, and he will not part with it, even if it would save Mary's life. When the doctor explains that the Count has been attacked and Mary kidnapped on Dorsal's orders, Stalbin finally admits that Dorsal bought the Turk from the Forester and that they both worked on it together. He also explains that the Turk's skyrocket crashed somewhere in the mountains. Moreover, Stalbin knows about the second Cyberman and that Dorsal uses him to attack his patrons. According to Stalbin, the second Cyberman was also damaged in the crash, but had a mind and some powers. The doctor explains to Stalbin that he is under the influence of the Cyberman. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to repair the technology century ahead of his time. Stalbin refuses to believe it.
So,
drama!
I like in general what's happening here. Like honestly, The last episode and a half are the part I enjoy probably the most of this, and the beginning of episode one. But what's kind of happened is you built up all of this mystery, let's say ineptly, in episode two, and then you have to spend a lot of time just basically explaining the mystery you set up here, and it's just a mess because like. Mary kind of gets forgotten for a while here. And she's supposed to be like the big character we're supposed to be excited about in this story.
She gets to bond with Graham. What else do you need?
That's the other thing. So
they're kicking it old school.
The first time I listened to this, I thought it was a joke. I thought it was a gag. It's like, what are you? Graham. It's like the least Cyberman meme ever. And I'm like, okay, there's a gag here I'm just not getting. And then I realized, no, that's
nope.
His name is just Graham. It's spelled differently because they're from Mondas, and apparently in our parallel Earth spelling works differently. But I
love Mondas.
Like, maybe it's supposed to be he's just a guy. Maybe he's like, you know, someone from Vienna that got converted. No, he's from Mondas. It's just a way to kind of tell the two characters apart, except for then we found out the other Cyberman's name is Brem, which is really hard to tell the parts when they're doing in a cyber voice of who's Graham and who's Brem. So I'm like, you gave them names. And then now the whole point was to make them distinctive. And then now they're confusing again.
But Eddie, we've already established that on Mondas, there were just people kicking it that slowly replaced parts of themselves. So right. Of course they have names or individuals. They have hopes and dreams and aspirations to avoid the cold. You know,
which again, like I don't mind, especially because these are Mondasian ones. This is before they lost all their individuality. So it's like, I'm on board with the premise. It was just every step of the way was so ineptly handled that it ended up feeling like it was a joke. And then it just became confusing again. So it's just like,
I'm angry. And I'm not a fan of the Doctor explaining the plot to us in episode 3, how you just talked about. And Stallman makes no sense to me. Even if he's under cyber influence, he still makes no sense.
Honestly, the whole cyber influence thing feels like we need Stallman to do these things because of plot.
And so then you don't hate him later, which is the thing I hate. I hate, 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 hate. If your villain's going to be a villain, let your villain be a villain.
Right.
Or honestly, at least if he's under cyber influence, give him moments where he, in the acting, he gets a chance to break free and do something a little different and then resubcomes to it. So it shows you that he's actually under influence and just not being a dick.
Right.
Ugh. Anything else before we move on?
Nope.
In a cage and alone, Mary mentions the other Cyberman who Graham believes is dead. And she says, no, he's alive with my friend, the Doctor. Enraged, Graham orders the puppets to action. It frees Mary, while Stallman tells the Doctor and the Countess he's planning to leave for Paris, London, or America. The Doctor's examination shows the Cyberman won't survive such a trip, and only a massive boost of energy that is unachievable in 19th century technology can save him. Bradfish appears with a message from the Empress commanding Stallman to perform with the Turk. As they get into the cab, Bradfish spots the driverless black cab with blue-eyed horses, and they leave in haste. The other Cyberman and Mary are pursuing them. Mary shouts to the Doctor to stop because Graham needs his companion. The Doctor shouts back at Mary to ask Graham why it's here, and both cabs crash as Bradfish does a weird turn so that no one gets killed, and it begins to rain. Graham reunited with Brim. Mary, still at odds with the Doctor, refusing any humanity to the Cyberman. She compares his description of them as monsters with his own state when she first met him. The Doctor learns that Graham thought that he was on Mondas. As the Doctor mocks the Cyberman and Mary defends him, Graham realizes he's on Earth. He scuttles away carrying both Brim and an unwilling Mary to find a power source to restore himself and his companion. Mary explains that her friends had experimented with electrostatic power of a storm with galvanic lightning to bring a man back to life, and the experiment was successful. The Doctor lived again. Graham decides to go to the top of the cathedral alone, up in the spire to the very tippy top. The Doctor reaches Mary, and she explains that she gave him the same idea that Percy Shelley used on the Doctor. The lightning strikes! The Cybermen are renewed! Cliffhanger.
And
Eddie, I hate it all.
That's great.
I hate all this.
You hate all of it, really?
I hate all this.
I like some of this.
Tell me what you like. Maybe you can convince me otherwise.
It's not going to be an impassioned plea, because, but like, if this is where the story was going, it's not a bad way of doing it. It's like, we have two Cybermen. I like Mary's continued arguing against the Doctor here. I stand by what we both agreed to, which is that the setup is not great. But since we're in this setup, Mary continues to be just objectively correct. You know, the Doctor is being inhuman. And McGann is trying to work with the lines to make, to come across as a bit alien. But there's just a bit too much happening for him to get the room to really pull that off. Right? Frankly, that argument needs to be a bit longer or something. But the part that I do dig is that the Doctor actually stops freaking out about the Cybermen when they're like, wait, you think you're on Mondas? And at that point in time, he starts to change gears into, okay, I don't have all the information. Maybe I need to reassess this a bit. Mary, who doesn't get the nuance of this, is just like, these people need help. And I did this thing before that helped you. I'm going to use it to help them. This is all perfectly logical. I like when a companion makes perfectly logical in-character decisions that still leads to trouble. Because I don't like companions who are stupid to get in trouble. And I don't like companions who are in trouble because the Doctor actively endangers them. This is one where Mary, through her own actions and her own morality and her own scientific knowledge for the early 1800s, led her to this place that turns out to be the wrong decision. Which, if the Doctor had said, oh, by the way, if we give them energy, they'll regenerate and probably want to turn you into a robot, maybe she would have slowed her roll. But he didn't, because again, the Eighth Doctor's coming across as kind of an asshole in this story.
And that is my biggest problem with this. I think I've said it multiple times, is I don't like that if your drama hinges on people not being able to speak to each other. Because the Doctor and Mary have been together enough, he could have easily at any point in time have shared that knowledge with her. Like, right. A 30-second conversation resolves almost all of this. This would not have happened. And I don't like it if your entire plot and everything hinges on that. It bothers me on an intrinsic level.
The other part, the other thing that bothers me about this is that the solution is actually in the script. Because earlier on, the Doctor said a thing about, I can't let anything bad happen to Mary, she'll write her books, right? That's something that gets picked up in the future stories. But in this story, it could have been very clearly put out. It's like, listen, I don't have time to explain Cybermen for you. I need you to get out of the situation. We need to get back to TARDIS, because if you don't write your books, think bad things happen. It could have been a different way of him not explaining the situation. Not in a, I'm going to be creepy and we're an alien, but rather in a, I don't have time because robot horses are plotting against you and I need to get you out of here.
And there's enough here that has bothered me so that I can't turn off my brain enough to just enjoy it. I'm thinking through logistically how things work. For instance, how does Graham unwillingly carries Mary and scuttles away? We'll assume Mary's like one and a half arms. Bram is slung over back. So it's giving you like one arm to balance your entire cyber body with. I'm giving Eddie like a visual description of what this was look like that you can't see. And he's cracking up. So how does that work, Eddie?
Cyber technology.
No. Just.
You know who wouldn't have this problem? Daleks.
Because they would just fly when they need to go.
Right. Exactly. So once again, point for the Daleks.
And
Cybermen are kind of rubbish.
Bradfish coming back with literally a message, knowing exactly where these people are.
From the Empress, stop. For no reason.
I can't, because there's so much here that my brain would not close down to enjoy it. It's like, how does Bradfish have that message? How does Bradfish know where they are? Why did Mitzi know where to meet Stalbin all this time, but didn't go and do anything about it when her new friend Mary got kidnapped?
And you know what the worst part is? Is I can actually solve the entire Bradfish problem too. Now that you mentioned the Empress thing, I just realized this is a very simple way to solve this. Bradfish is the spy of the Empress. That would have solved this entire fucking subplot.
But it won't, because in the next part, we find out why.
Well,
which I'm not going to spoil yet. So that doesn't work either. So Bradfish has to work for Dorsal. There's no other way it works.
Well, he's got to be his henchman. Right.
Because he's everywhere. has to be a henchman.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, that's where the story's obviously going, and it just doesn't. It's they run into each other in episode one, gives them free tickets. It should be he gets subverted in episode two, and then the reason why he's everywhere is because his eyes have been replaced, and Dorsal can see through his eyes, and he's a spy for Dorsal. Right, that's how it should go. That's not how it goes. The only other option is that he's working for somebody that explains the Empress connection. He's a spy for the Empress. But again, the story doesn't go that way. It's overly complicated. And I think what's frustrating about it is it's not necessary to be overcomplicated. Like, for example, Neverland is overcomplicated. Don't get me wrong. Neverland is stupidly overcomplicated. But Neverland is intended to be an overcomplicated tying off of hours and hours and hours of audio drama. Mm-hmm. This didn't need to be this complicated. The writer made this mess for themselves.
All right. Anything else? I'm going to probably speed go through this last part.
Yeah, because episode four, a lot happens.
Yeah. So I'm going to give it. We'll see what I decide to do because, you know, it's me. The regenerated Cybermen leap from the spire. Mary tells the doctor about the Cybermen's plan is that their mission is not complete yet. Mary realizes that much of what happened is her fault. The doctor comforts her by saying that sometimes the worst things result from the best of intentions. Mary says that's a chilling thought. You know what? I'm not going to do that. Eddie.
Yep.
It's going to work out like this. All of that boils down to Brim gives up the rest of his bits to Graham. Graham then has the puppets go and they kidnap the doctor. The doctor and Mary encounter automaton duplicates of themselves. The count is killed. And in the end, they want the doctor's sonic device to use it to boost to send a message to the other Cybermen. Mary destroys the doctor's sonic screwdriver. Brim is upset. Shenanigans ensue. They beat the Cybermen. And at the end, we get Stallman and Mitzi married with the Silver Doctor roaming around Vienna. Boom. Done. Out.
Right. That's basically it. And again, like, the image of a Cyberman controlling these little kind of puppets and doing stuff with them is cool and creepy. But out of left field, we have this entire subplot of these puppets are going to replace people. And you were saying before that episode three is where you lost all cohesion. This is where I lost it. Because I'm like, everyone in the story has made it very clear, oh, those are puppets. They're obviously puppets. So how are they going to fool with this wooden carving of a person that happens to have – oh, well, they have human eyes, so that just – blows through all this guy's options. You know, they have human eyes, so therefore they're very clearly, obviously human. There, at no point does the story explain that the transference of the eyes into the puppets makes them appear human.
And it doesn't. It fools people for about 30 seconds until they step out of the shadow.
Right.
And that's where one of my problems comes is that we know they're carved out of the wood, but has the wood been dyed a certain color? How woody is woody? Do they actually look like the people at all? Or are they just vague recollections that sound like them somehow also? So do they get recordings of everyone's voice and they pop it in there? Too many unanswered questions for me.
Right. And it's this is where the each more episodes or needs to be cut down, because if Russell's pan had just been, I'm just going to burn shit down with my amazing puppet army, fine. That's evil enough.
I too, but like the Autons.
Right, exactly. But I mean, it's we have to introduce the Empress purely so that she can get captured and replaced. And in the midst of all of this stuff, he also had time to build puppets of Mitzi, of Mary Shelley, of the Doctor. And I like the creepiness of the Doctor going, where are my eyes? Where are my eyes? I mean, like, there's some really creepy moments that plays with that premise, but it's so disjointed from everything that's happened before, which is already pretty disjointed. We're left with just a bundle of plot stuff. And it makes an attempt to tie it all together, but at this point in time, I just don't care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And like, Mitzi shows no remorse for her husband being dead.
I have even more problems with that. Mitzi goes and marries Stallman, and they're traveling around, and her kid is gone. No concern about her husband, her kid, mm-hmm. any of it. So we assume whatever money they had left, she took with Stallman, and their love story continues.
Yeah. I do like the fact that, again, Mary makes a very logical decision. The Cybermen need a sonic device to do their thing. This is the sonic device they've captured. Destroy the sonic device. Their plan has failed. She is correct. And there's a bit of like, oh, I'm sorry, I stole your sonic screwdriver. It's like, I have a whole closet of them, which annoys me on the fact that that's just not fucking true. Because two incarnations of the Doctor without a sonic screwdriver. But I know why, and it's just a production thing. It's a gag. I'm not super really mad about it. But it does kind of it undercuts Mary a little bit in a way that I don't like. She generally throughout this story, when she is allowed to be present in the story, Mary Shelley is quite good. She's actually a really good companion. She's smart. She's capable. She's using what knowledge she has from early 1800s to apply the situation. She feels like a lot like a higher class version of Leela in the sense of, I don't have all the knowledge, even that the audience has, but it's not always played for I'm stupid. It's played for I'm very smart with the limited information I have.
Interesting. I thought she came across as a better version of Jamie than Leela.
So that's another possibility, but they're both in the same boat, right? Yeah. Someone who coming from a point of information that's even less than the audiences have. Jamie's usually played for laughs. That's why I didn't go for him. But I think they both have the same point. It's like when Jamie's not being played for laughs, he's genuinely a very capable character.
Because my thing that I didn't go for Leela is because Leela came from an alien planet and that they were somewhat acquainted with advanced technology, at least in passing.
That's fair.
Compared to Jamie that had no points of reference for it.
Right. And compared to other historical female companions who are generally, again, we're not talking about Charlie here, but other ones have generally treated really badly. So she's very firmly in the modern Who mold of a strong, capable companion who puts up with the Doctor's shit and challenges him. The problem is everything around her is bullshit. The story makes no sense, and things that she's saying that are supposed to be fun little comments on how nerdy Doctor Who fans can get instead come across as genuinely questioning what the hell is going on in the plot. It's supposed to be a metatextual joke for fans. It's really a metatextual critique on the story she's in.
So, yeah. All right. Let's wrap this up.
So I liked it.
We both said up top that we were critical of it, but we both like it. The thing is, I like it not so much for the writing itself, but from how it's acted and executed. Like, absolutely. That is the most sweeping part that draws you in. And the introduction of a new companion that has done one of the best introductions for a companion. Because it gives you a chance to live through Mary, even though she disappears for bits of it. But even when she's not in it, she's actively doing something to propel the plot forward, good or bad.
Yeah. Julie Cox, 100%, is the highlight of this story, right? Every time when you can tell it's her, and frankly, half the time you can tell between Mary and Mitzi is because Mary's more interesting to listen to. And that's not to denigrate the actor who played Mitzi. It's just that's how the writing came down. But, like, all the stuff she has with McGann is gold. All the stuff she has with Graham is gold. There are great conversations between her and McGann. The only reason why McGann's also not amazing is because he's acting. He's at a certain base level of a really strong actor. He's not quite pushing himself in this story. But that is a critiquing with faint damnation, if you will. I've always liked McGann. I think he's one of the stronger Doctor actors, and particularly in audio, because that's primarily where he lives, so he knows that medium very well. He's clearly trying to work with the script to the best of his ability. And it's clear that he and Julie Cox have amazing energy. Again, I think McGann is really good at just syncing up with actors and making a connection with them. He shows it again here. And it makes you want to hear more of these characters, which is what you want in an introductory story. It's compelling. It's interesting. It feels like Doctor Who. It makes you want to hear more about his adventures with Mary Shelley. It does all those things well. And all the other actors, even, given what they had, are not doing bad. Obviously, yeah. Both Saruman sound similar because they're both being played by Nick Briggs, but also because all Saruman sound similar. So, that you can't blame Nick for that. That's what they do.
And I will give one definite compliment for the script, though, is that it stuck to an old model of Doctor Who, is that one pseudo companion that's close to the Doctor usually always dies. And my man, Bradfish, gets killed.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
almost a throwaway death, but he gets killed because they find his dead body.
Again, I keep going back to this, is a very Robert Holmesian move, right? That doesn't mean very much happens in a lot of Robert Holmes scripts, is that the Doctor Who picks up the companion of the story and that companion dies. There's a lot to like about this, but in the sense of this is something you listen to when you're out walking your dog or you're driving or something and you're not really paying attention to the story. Yeah, right. If you're trying to actually pay attention to the story, it falls apart very quickly. If you're just listening to it to enjoy the sound of the actors doing their thing, it's extremely enjoyable.
Any final comments on The Silver Turk?
In a way, I'm glad you picked it because it is a very good example of mediocre Big Finish. It is not something standard. Like I said, I forgot the nuances of the story like halfway into it, even though on the flip side, I didn't even re-listen to Chimes of Midnight because I knew that story so well. Because I could tell you so much about it because it's such a great story. Not all Big Finish is great, and some of it's actively bad. Mm-hmm. When you make hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these, you're going to have a variation in quality. This is, to me, very indicative of Big Finish at its – this is good baseline quality. The acting is usually pretty good. There's some couple of good speeches in it. The audio design, which we haven't talked about, the audio design was fine through it. The actual – how the audio was presented – as it came down to the writing was muddy, as you talked about, but the actual sound effects and the pacing of it was edited perfectly. I was never confused about the moment-to-moment action. How it was all connecting together was very confusing, but
yes,
how the characters relating to each other and the space they were in was always extremely clear, which is something that's actually really hard to do in audio, and Big Finish has always been good at that.
All right. Eddie, it is that yes. time. I gave you a time. Prompt earlier to prepare for it.
I did.
What if I was a brand new audio listener looking to get my groove on with Doctor Who would be 3 to 5 titles I should start with to avoid the bad and possibly the mediocre and hook me with the great?
So I'm going to give you 2 lists, actually. One of free options and one of paid options. We've talked before about how a lot of these are on Spotify. And there's, I think there's a couple other services now that have some of this stuff. I think maybe Amazon Music may have some, whatever. But anyway, Big Finish has put a bunch of their stuff up for free. And of those, I would pick, we talked about it before, but Storm Warning, which is the first Eighth Doctor adventure. It's a good entry point into the Charlie era of Eighth Doctor. And there's a lot of good stuff to go through that. A lot of bad stuff too, but there's some good stuff in there. The entry point for the Fourth Doctor adventures, which you haven't talked about at all, Destination Nerva. The Fourth Doctor, if you like Tom Baker, it's Tom Baker. They're not trying to be experimental with him, but they're also not they're just, let's give Tom Baker scripts where he's doing Tom Baker stuff. And that's pretty much the Fourth Doctor range. So you can start with Destination Nerva. It's another version of the Ark in Space, Revenge of Cybermen, Nerva Station. So it's a few fun little callback to the story. It's the right amount of Doctor Who nerddom. But in terms of just a random story that's in the middle of the monthly range, that's fantastic. Spare Parts.
Yes.
Spare Parts is Genesis Daleks for the Cybermen. And I will actually go so far as to say it is better than Genesis the Daleks. Spare Parts is fantastic. It's the Fifth Doctor at his best. It's exactly the kind of script that Peter Davison is perfect for.
I'm glad you mentioned that one, because if we had done the Fifth Doctor run for Big Finish, that is the one I would have chose. That one I can do without having to re-listen to it.
Yeah, yeah. Outside of that, for paid options, if you like the new era, David Tennant's actually done a fair number of 10th Doctor adventures. So 10th Doctor Adventures Volume 1, it is him and Donna. So it's very traditional Dr. Donna style stories. And they're both really good. In fact, there is a podcast called Into the TARDIS where Colin Baker is hosting a wide variety of Big Finish stuff. And they started with one of the Dr. Donna stories from the first volume of 10th Doctor Adventures. So that's another free way to do it. If you, again, like 8th Doctor, I mentioned the Dark Eyes. That's kind of the start of the third big era of eight that has Molly, who is a brief companion, but she's wonderful. And then that leads pretty quickly into the Livchenka companion era. And Livchenka is amazing. I love her to death. And then outside of that, also, 9th Doctor has recently come on board, Chris Eccleston. And so you can start with Ravagers, which is the first of the 9th Doctor adventures. And from all told, we talked before about how Chris Eccleston's very down on coming back on televised Doctor Who, but he's clearly having a blast on Big Finish. I remember one interview where he said he went onto Reddit to do an AMA, and people were asking questions about the continuity. And he's like, listen, it doesn't matter. I'm just here to play a doctor again. You're either on board with that or you're not. I'm like, that is exactly what I want. That's exactly what I want. It's like, fuck you, fanboys. Here's some more Doctor Who. Shut up and love it. And it's like, yes, I will do that, Mr. Eccleston, sir.
Well, that's the big thing about, I think I've noticed for Christopher Eccleston, is he says what he thinks. There is very little, like, how this will impact my career filter. It is, this is who I am. This is what I think. Fuck off if you don't like it.
And I respect that.
Lots of respect for that.
And the fact that he's still doing a number of these, in fact, he was also part of a Big Finish loves doing celebration stuff. They did a 60th anniversary big celebration, which I've not listened to, but it's basically 8 discs of just every actor they could possibly cram into a Doctor Who story. But Eccleston is part of that glorious nonsense. So clearly he's still having a good time with Big Finish. And so it sounds like we have more coming from him. So that's a good sign. That means that now every doctor from 4 to 10 is actively working for Big Finish.
And I think I mentioned it before, but as I finished it now, Christopher Eccleston is also in the True Detective Night Country, which is a great series that I think people should watch. And it ends differently than you think it would. It's still very good.
Okay.
Eddie, how about this? Do you want to let people know what the next 3 episodes are going to be?
Sure. So I had to say, like, next 3. Okay, never mind. So we love doing Doctor Who. And in fact, we were doing Doctor Who before we did Doctor Who. So Chris and I agreed we're going to pull an episode out of the Patreon vaults. And we're going to give you 2 episodes of when we talked about Power of the Doctor. It was so long, I actually could cut it into 2 episodes. So that's next couple of weeks. You're going to get to
Patreon episode.
Yeah, the very first Patreon episodes, and it was, again, we watched that before any of the 60th anniversary stuff. This is before Shooty was announced, even, I think. So it was just, so you hear a lot of me going, this is feels like an anniversary special, even though it's not. And I stand by that. It has a lot of the vibes, and frankly, it's one of the better. It had very kind of Caves of Anajandri vibes of, like, why is this one of the best stories of the Doctor that's about to go out, you know? The Power of the Doctor is a big dumb anniversary special. It's great. So we talked about that for 2 hours, so we get to do with that. And then at the end of that, we will finally wrap up, until we do it again, our discussion of classic Doctor Who. So we will talk about everything we have discussed, all the way from, oh my god, the Daleks, to, oh my god, the Cybermen here.
If people are and we're not going to say what we're going to do for our next season yet. We've got 3 or 4 different ideas. Maybe by the wrap-up episode, we'll have it figured out. Maybe. Who knows? If people are looking to contact you online or get some of your sweet, sweet swag, we're going to do that.
Right now, the best sweet swag to get, actually, would be to do a pre-order for Curious Cats of Mao. We just finished our crowdfunding campaign. That is the cat supplement for Realms of Pugmire. So if you want to play a cat in my dog game, you can now do that. We did reasonably well. I was pretty happy with how it turned out, all things considered. But obviously, the more pre-orders we can get, the more that I can then go to Onyx Path and they can more comfortable investing in even more creator own stuff that I've made. So definitely go check that out. You can find that out through realmsofpugmire.com, where you can find all my Pugmire stuff. If you want any of my other stuff, you can get that through Pugsteady. That's my website. That's me online. Or you can come chat with us in the Darker Hue Discord, where I'm talking about how I recommended a book series and now I deeply regret it.
Yeah, I saw that. I don't blame you for regretting it now. If you're looking to pick up my stuff, I am actually no longer with IPR, and I've got copies of Haunted West I would love to sell because I'm running low, and I'd rather just have them all gone. So then maybe one day I can consider a second edition. You can do that at the Darker Hue Studios website. If you want a Home Unbound second edition book, you can go to Chaosium's website and buy that and tell them that you want more and more of that book. Otherwise, I'll be seeing you.
We'll see you in 2 weeks, but you'll hear from us next week.